Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, two topics today, important of the last week. The first I want to talk about is a piece I wrote early this past week on Monday, before the media folks began to get attracted to it. It's called The Great Strike of 2021. Check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, published on Monday, last Monday. Also, you can read it in Counterpunch. I think it was the 13th by the time I got there. ZNED and various places. Okay, The Great Strike of 2021. Secondly, I want to talk about what's going on with inflation. And in particular, will Biden's recent press conference, where he announced he's going to do something about making the LA ports run on 24/7, really solve the problem? Is supply-driven, supply-broken supply chains, global supply chains, and other supply problems driving up inflation significant levels going to continue into next year? Or is it, quote, temporary, as the Fed was saying? No, it's not going to be temporary. And does that mean we are going to have a bout of what's called stagflation, where the economy slows and inflation rises anyway? You know, they're supposed to be inversely related, right? If you got inflation, you got a booming economy. Well, the Atlanta Federal Reserve, which has this predictive shadow GDP, has said that their estimate for third quarter GDP is being reduced to 1.3% GDP growth. That follows a 6.7% growth in the second quarter. In other words, big slowdown going on. Is it all supply driven? Well, we'll discuss that. But if you got a slowdown in real economic growth, GDP, and you got inflation, then you got stagnation, stag, and inflation, stagflation. We haven't seen that since the late 1970s, early 80s. Okay, so we'll take on that topic here. I want to talk about the Great Strike of 2021 first. Okay, again, check out my blog piece at jackrasmus.com. And the follow-on addendum I wrote to it, and that is, how the hell are workers coping, surviving financially if they're not going back to work? Because that's what we got. We've got what amounts to the striking of the unorganized, the non-union workforce. Of course, we're seeing more strikes begin to occur on the union side, too, as the same phenomenon bleeds over into the labor movement, the unions. We'll talk about those strikes, in particular the John Deere UAW strike going on, the Kellogg workers, West Coast nurses and hospitals, pending strikes almost sure to occur with various blue-collar workers over down there in Hollywood, IATSE, IATSE union, International Association of Television and blah, blah, blah. Okay, 60,000 of those may walk out. In other words, we got a little mini strike wave emerging here on the unionized side we haven't seen for many years. Okay, let's jump into this, the Great Strike of 2020. What's a strike? Well, a strike, very simply, is when workers withhold their labor. It's that simple. You know, people think, oh, unions go on strike. Well, no, workers can strike without a union. You know, historically, they've often gone out on strike just to form a union. In other words, the strike begins before the unionization occurs. It's not necessarily so that you always have to have a union to go on strike. Strike is just withholding your labor. And that's what millions of workers are doing. They're withholding their labor. They're not going back to work, which raises the important question, well, why not? Why aren't they going back to work? And then, of course, the follow-on question, well, not going back to work, how are they surviving? Okay, some statistics here, right? According to the Economic Policy Institute, good source for labor issues here in Washington, D.C., in the second quarter of this year, April to June, workers returned to their jobs at a rate of 889,000 a month, almost 3 million. Contrast that with the rate of return in the third quarter, July through September. That was only 280,000 a month. So we go from almost 900,000 to less than 300,000. In fact, in September, the number was only 194,000, according to the Labor Department's Employment Situation Report. Economists, by the way, mainstream, had predicted 500,000 workers in September would return to work. Well, only 194,000. Oh, they only missed it by 300,000. They're not known for their forecasts very well, especially with this pandemic situation, because it's upset, you know, the pandemic COVID has totally upset labor markets. And by the way, product markets, we see what the shortage is. And we will soon see capital markets, financial side. That's coming too. Okay, so 900,000 down to 280,000, and actually only 194,000, even less in the last month of September, third quarter, September. The trend is undeniable, right? Big slowdown in recovery as the economy continued to open over the summer. Big slowdown in jobs. Workers aren't coming back to work. Why not? That's the question. How many? First, let's tackle that. How many are we talking about? Well, if you compare using the Labor Department's own data from employment situation reports, the monthly reports on jobs, right? If you compare where we were in January, February of 2020, right before the COVID, right? And where we are as of September this year, we are still 5 million jobs fewer than we had before COVID began. Now, that's a conservative and lowball number. Keep that in mind, the 5 million, right? You got to understand that over 4 million people have dropped out of the labor force at the same time. 4 million. That's, you know, estimated based on the labor force participation rate collapsing. So, you know, you got 5 million, according to the government's figures, fewer employed. You got over 4 million dropped out of the labor force. And you got another million probably still of unemployed who were improperly estimated by the Labor Department as employed. Well, how can that be? Well, when this whole crisis began and hit hard in March and April of 2020, many employees were told to stay home by their employer. They weren't working. They weren't getting paid. But the Labor Department, Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, estimates through surveys, phone surveys every month, calls people, and it asks them, are you out of work? And if they say yes, and then they ask them, do you expect to be returned to work? And if you say no, well, then you're unemployed. But if you say yes, oh, I expect to be returned to work. I'm only furloughed by my company. I'm not laid off by my company. I still have that connection. I'm just not getting paid. I'm furloughed, you see. Not the same as unemployed. And if they in the survey said, oh, yeah, I'm going to be called back here. It's only a couple months, right? I'm not unemployed. Then the Labor Department says, oh, okay, you're not unemployed. You're just furloughed. And, you know, a lot of women in particular were in that situation. They stayed home. They had to watch their kids because the kids weren't going to school. They were going to be in, you know, remote learning, you know, that abomination called remote learning. And they had to watch the kids. They were furloughed. Now, that's a mistake because they weren't working. They weren't getting paid. You know, so they should be considered unemployed. But the Labor Department said, oh, no, they're furloughed. They're not unemployed. So they underestimated the people who were unemployed by several millions initially here, and there's at least a million of them. Now, the Labor Department admitted that was a mistake soon after, but they didn't change it, you see. They've kept it that way. They've kept that error, even though they admitted themselves as wrong. So, you know, it's about a million of those. So you take 5 million, official number, fewer workers today, haven't come back to work. You add those who are dropped out that don't get counted. You know, you drop out. You know, you're not part of the labor force, therefore you don't get counted as employed or unemployed. Yeah, that's one way they keep the unemployment numbers low. And then you add maybe a million still, although the number's going down. Well, you know, you're still around 9 million. You know, even if you figure, oh, well, not all the dropouts are refusing to come to work. You know, some of them maybe, you know, decided to retire early or something like that. So let's say 3 million. Three of the 4.3 million, 5 million official number, a million still improperly defined. You got about 9 million. Okay. Now, you know, a simple rule of thumb, not all of them are workers who are refusing to turn to work. You know, some are still getting unemployment benefits. And, you know, there may be other reasons why. But, you know, we can do a rule of thumb and we can say, well, let's say at least half of the 9-10 million are probably workers who don't want to return to work. That's 5 million. 4 to 5 million people out there, workers who are refusing. Well, why are they doing that? And, you know, where are these people, these workers concentrated? Well, you know, they think, well, it's got to be, you know, hotels and restaurants, maybe retail, right? That's obvious. Those folks are the most abused, really, in terms of working conditions and pay. But it's not. It's across the board because there are low-paid workers everywhere, not just in hotels and bars and restaurants. They're everywhere in the economy. In the last 20 years, American businesses have been squeezing the hell out of workers, not given, and Congress, of course, not given minimum wage increases. You know, it's been, what, 11 years since the last one? I mean, it's an obscenity that the federal minimum wage is only $7.25 still. They won't raise it. Some states have, blue states, red states won't do it, you know. So, you know, the pay is so low. The pay is so low. This great strike of 2021 is a strike of the low paid. And they are everywhere. Temp workers in manufacturing. And you'd be surprised how many temp workers, low paid temp workers, are in manufacturing, especially the deunionized sector, which is very large now in manufacturing. You know, unions only represent in the private sector only like 6%. 6% of the workforce. It's never been that low since 1919. I think it was even higher back then, 1919. You know, a century ago, the labor union movement, since Ronald Reagan, has been thrown back a century in terms of membership. Now, there's still workers in the public sector, you know, because you can't offshore those jobs very easy, right? Yeah, and public workers have more of a political leverage over their employers than private workers do. And it's mostly because, you know, you can't offshore them. So we still have, you know, I think about 30% membership, union membership in the public sector, you know, state and local government, mostly teachers. You know, we got, what, 20 million people, 18, 20 million people before this who worked in state and local government. About 18 million of those were teachers. There were only like a couple million workers in the federal sector. And then you got the state and city workers, but it's mostly teachers. I think like 16, 17 million of public workers are teachers. Okay. But if you look at the distribution of those who aren't coming back to work, the low paid, right? They're everywhere, not just leisure and hospitality. The government's statistics, for example, show last month, leisure and hospitality, 1.6 million fewer workers today, September, that's the number, compared to before the COVID Great Recession 2.0 really began. That would be January, February 2020. 1.6 million. Ah, but look, healthcare industry, still 524,000 fewer workers. You would think, oh gosh, healthcare, things are going, you know, gangbusters there in terms of hiring. We need all the people we can. No. No. Personal services, professional personal services. Oh, you would think, oh, these are the skilled people, you know, professional services. Still down at 385,000. Education. Wow, we've opened up the schools, right? Everybody's back, right? No, 676,000 fewer workers in education services than before COVID. Well, then certainly manufacturing and construction shouldn't be short because essentially manufacturing did not shut down through the whole COVID crisis. Did not shut down. Oh, not so. 353,000 fewer jobs still in manufacturing, even when all this so-called shortages producing goods. 353,000 still short in manufacturing. Well, it's because you got a lot of temps in manufacturing. Shitty jobs. And that's one of the reasons workers aren't coming back. You know, they had a chance now to step back and say, what a shitty job I got, you know, low wage, no benefits, jerking my hours of work around, you know, I can't even get, you know, get childcare for my kids because I don't know what the hell my schedule's going to be, you know, that's abuse. Construction down 200,000 jobs still, right? That's the 5 million official. That's the 5 million official Labor Department, fewer workers today. But I would say on top of that, you got to add the dropouts, at least a good portion of them, and this 1 million, you know, falsely classified as furloughed and working. Okay. So we got 4 to 5 million who are de facto on strike, right, withholding their labor. That's the simple definition, right? We have the Great Strike of 2021. We're in the middle of that. And, you know, now the pundits are catching on to it. You know, after I wrote my article, you know, Robert Reich produced one in The Guardian, and then, you know, Paul Krugman comes out with a column today, The Revolted American Worker, right? Now, this thing has been brewing for months, right? It was obvious that soon as the economy started to significantly reopen this past spring, that the workers weren't coming back, you know, especially once we hit June, July. Well, you know, immediately, the politicians, right, and the right-wingers and, you know, the employer groups and so forth began using the fact workers weren't coming back to attack the unemployed. They started in June saying, it's because they're getting too generous unemployment benefits. You know, we had two kinds of unemployment benefits during the pandemic. We had the regular traditional state unemployment benefits, and then we had a supplement overlaid on that called the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Act. That provided unemployment benefits for the first time for potentially 10 million independent workers. In other words, freelancers and gig workers, right, contract workers and so forth, which up till the pandemic had no access to unemployment benefits, but that's a big growing part of the economy. So now they were given the PUA, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. And then those on regular state unemployment were given a supplement to their state unemployment. At first in 2020, it was $600 a week, but then it was reduced to $300 a year ago. The conservatives, the ideologists for business and so forth began to argue, it's that the unemployment benefits are too rich, you know, let's cut them out, force them to come back to work. And that's what they did in the red states, you see. They cut the unemployment benefits, the supplemental unemployment benefits. They couldn't cut the state benefits because that's already there. Right? So they cut. How did they cut it? It's a national program. How did these governors, you know, in Kentucky and Tennessee and places simply take, you know, cut the unemployment benefits? Well, they simply said so, even though they could continue paying the supplemental unemployment. They just said so. Well, we're not going to do it. Probably illegal. But, you know, nowadays these red state governments and legislatures do what the hell they want. And the Democrats are kind of feebly trying to deal with it ineffectively. That's another story. But they just cut it out. And you know what? It didn't bring people back to work faster. No. If you compare the return to work rates in these red states after June, July, August, to those states like California and New Jersey that continued the supplemental benefits until they officially ran out in September, the blue states, California and so forth, had a higher return rate than those states, red states, that cut unilaterally, arbitrarily, the unemployment benefits early. So much for that argument, right? But that's part of the whole capitalist ideology, you see. Blame the victim. Always find a way to blame the victim, blame the worker for the problems, you know, that the capitalists create. Well, now you know what they're saying. Now in the red states, they're saying, we didn't go far enough cutting unemployment benefits. What we got to cut is food stamps. Oh, that's too generous, right? And these child care benefits that kicked in July are really what's keeping workers off the job. So we got to cut the child care benefits. Well, those child care benefits are going to disappear at the end of December anyway. But they're just changing their story. They're just saying that, the workers got it too good. Yeah, they got it too soft, the too much benefits, right? So let's starve them out, you know? It's kind of what employers do in a strike, you know? Starve them out. Take away their health insurance and their other benefits here, and starve them out. Okay, so why are workers able to hold out? What's going on? Well, you know, workers are pretty clever, and when it comes to a strike, they find ways to make ends meet, oftentimes. You know, but consider, the fact that maybe there's someone else in their family that has gone back to work, and they can get by that way, right? Maybe if they're very low paid, they look around and they say, hey, if I go back to work, I got no benefits at this job. But if I stay away from work, at least I can get Medicaid. Or maybe, you know, the government's program of subsidizing COBRA, C-O-B-R-A, that's an acronym. You can, if you get laid off a company that has has insurance, health insurance benefits, you can continue them by picking it up under what was called, or continuing your benefits if you're laid off, what's called COBRA, right? Very expensive, you know, like $1,500 a month. But the government, as part of the pandemic stuff, has been subsidizing that. That ends, or maybe it's already ended, but it will end soon, if not. You know, because we got creeping austerity. They're slowly taking away all these benefits, right? But maybe, you know, a worker very low paid says, hey, you know, at least I'm getting Medicaid. If I go back to work, this company has nothing, and I'm worse off, right? The big reason why I think they're going, one of the big reasons why they're not going back to work is that they can't find childcare. Not only is childcare unaffordable, they can't find it. There's not enough of childcare workers around. So they can't go back to work if they got young kids, right? Especially if the schools aren't open full time, or a lot of them are on this silly thing called hybrid, where you, a couple days a week, you go to school, a couple days a week, you'd go remote. I mean, that's the worst of both solutions, right? And then workers say, hey, you know, if I go back to work, they didn't give me any guaranteed hours. You know, they jerked me around. And, you know, employers aren't bringing people back full time. They're testing the water, you know, bringing them back a little bit, part time. Especially in the services, and then watch and see whether the economy really takes off or not. So people get called back to work, but a few more hours, which means less pay for the week. Why the hell should they go back in that scenario? Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? Especially if you go to commute, the cost of commuting. You know, yeah, I mean, I'm going to make less money if I go back to work. Yeah, the unemployment benefits are only part of what I was making, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to make what I was. Or at least, will the employer continue it? Because they've been jerking me around for 18 months, they say. You know, oh, I call back to work, and then no, you know, shifts and schedules and everything up in the air. We have no civilized paid leave in this country. You see, every other industrial advanced capitalist country has paid leave. We don't even give paid leave as a national program to pregnant mothers. You know what they get in Europe? They get 6 to 9 months of paid leave for pregnant mothers. God, we treat people so badly in this country. Employers and politicians are just squeezing the hell out of most workers. And they're getting pissed off. Understandably so, right? Oh, but it's the fault of the workers. You see, it's the fault of the workers. That's the ideology. I mean, just read these. If you read a Wall Street Journal, you know, they got editorial page, these assholes like Phil Graham and everything, they come up with all these counter-arguments. You can come up with an argument, you know, against minimum wage and everything. You can come up with arguments, but they're all bogus. They're all, half of them are lies. The other half are twisting the facts, right? Look, decades-long practices on unlivable low wages, right? Fewer no benefits, terrible working conditions, hours of work, and so forth, right? Workers say, oh, you had a chance to step back and think about this. And now they're figuring out, you know, how to manipulate the system for a while and not go back to work while they're thinking about, hey, you know, maybe there's something better over here or over there. And they're considering it, and they're probably looking for those jobs. In the meantime, they're withholding their labor. It's called the Great Strike. It's not a general strike. Robert Reich says it's a general strike. No, that's something different. This is not a general strike. It is a major strike wave. 5 million people How many lost work days that amounts to? Well, we will see when the calculations come in. But there's 5 million people. Now, we haven't seen this kind of a strike wave in 50 years. You got to go back to 1970-71 to see a similar strike wave. Then the strike wave was led by the unions, which were still strong, hadn't been offshored and decimated yet. 1970 construction workers used to have big regional contracts, like all of Northern California, you know, all of New York State and stuff like that, right? And they could take on their employers and win. And manufacturing workers, you know, auto workers, like 2 million members then, Teamsters, 2 million members. And from the construction strike wave came the Teamsters, who began walking out. Because the Teamsters, you know, delivered the stuff to the work sites in construction. They saw what the construction trades were getting and said, well, we want it too. So they went on strike. And, of course, they deliver stuff into auto factories and so forth, and it spilled over to autos and other basic manufacturing. And from there, it spilled over to transport, longshore. Major strike wave, 70, 71. And listen to this. They won their strikes, and they got 25% increases in the first year of three-year agreements. Think of that, a 25% raise in wages and benefits in the first year. That's a victory. Those strikes were victories, big time. People don't know their own history. That was a very successful strike wave. In fact, it was so successful that the employers had to call on President Richard Nixon at the time to stop it. The government intervened and stopped it. In August 1971, Nixon imposed a wage freeze on major collective bargaining agreements. Yes, a wage freeze. Stopped them in their tracks. And then set up, you know, a wage board, a pay board, that rolled back those 25% increases to no more than 5.5%. And the AFL-CIO, George Meany, and all those other flunkies went along with it. Yeah, they rolled back their big gains that they fought so hard for. They had to call in the state, the employers, to help them. Nixon passed what's called his New Economic Program at the time, which included the wage freeze and the rollbacks after, but also included measures that helped U.S. capitalists compete with their foreign competitors, particularly Europeans, that were challenging the U.S. because Europe had finally recovered in the 60s from the Second World War, and they were cutting into U.S. exports. And they were beating out the Americans. So the second element of the new economic program was to impose tariffs on European imports to the U.S. and to give tax subsidies to American companies to compete with Europeans in Europe. And thirdly, to suspend the International Monetary System provision that provided for an exchange of dollars for gold at the rate of $32 for an ounce of gold. You see, that was what the U.S. set up in 1944. And the dollar became the backstop to the gold system then. It was like a partial gold system. And if you had dollars, you could exchange them with the U.S. government for gold. And that's what the Europeans were doing, you see, because they were accumulating dollars, beating out the U.S. in trade. They were accumulating dollars, and they said, well, we want your gold, Uncle Sam. And they were getting it more and more. And Nixon got worried, oh, we can't let the Europeans have all our gold. So as part of his new economic program, Nixon simply suspended the exchange of gold for dollars. And that was that. The U.S. had the power globally to do that back then. Okay, so those three elements, you know, the trade elements, the dollar elements, and the wage freeze. Now, part of the wage freeze was they're going to impose a price commission that was supposed to keep prices at no more than 2% while they were freezing wages. But that was a big farce, because the 2% was for the economy as a whole, not for individual prices on individual products, and employers simply raised prices. That continued until 1973, when both the wage freeze and the price controls collapsed. The way they really tamed wages after the collapse of the official controls was they engineered a big recession. They, meaning Congress, because inflation was raging, a big, you know, in 1973, a big increase in interest rates by the Federal Reserve and a collapse of government spending threw us into the 73-75 recession, and that's what took away the rest of the 5.5% gains, you see. That's how the state works, you see. If the unions defeat the employers on the ground, well, they bring in their buddies in the state apparatus to fight for them, they meaning employers. And that's what they did. Now, that was the big strike wave. There was another big strike wave of the post-war period when we came out of World War II. That was in 45-46. About 8 million workers were involved in the 45-46 strike wave. About 5 million unionized, mostly in 70-71. And now we got about 5 million here in this third strike wave, right? Of course, in terms of workdays lost, 70-71, 114 million workdays were lost during that strike wave, right? And before that, 154 million in 45-46. We don't have calculations how many workdays are lost here in the third strike wave, but it's a great strike wave going on, right? Composed mostly of non-unionized workforce, lower-paid service workers, but also truckers, delivery drivers in the cities, long-haul truckers trying to get to the ports, hospitality workers in hotels and restaurants, retail workers, low-paid on construction projects, teachers, bus drivers, nurses, warehouse workers, food processing workers, right? Home health care workers. It's across the board. It's the low paid that aren't coming back, right? But also could be very much the skilled. You know, just because you're low paid doesn't mean you're not skilled. Try driving an 18-wheeler. See how much skill you need for that, right? Lots. Okay, that's the great strike wave. Read my article, jackrasmus.com, on my blog, or take a look at Counterpunch. Online, if you want, or ZNet online. There's other places that's appeared. I'm not sure where they are. Okay, let's talk about the other main topic of the past week, and that is inflation. Yeah. Well, what's causing the inflation? Well, what is the inflation? Well, consumer price index is up 5.4%. August to August, August 20 to August 21, up 5.4%, which is pretty high. Right? Actually, it's higher for median income families, because that 5.4% is for a national average of all income groups. It's made up of about 400 or so different products and services that people buy, and they have their weights, you see. Food costs have a greater weight, and lodging costs than do maybe buying laptops or cell phones, right? To come up with that 5.4%. Well, those are national weights across all income groups, but the weights are really different, should be different for people with median incomes and below. And if you had the different weights, it would show a higher inflation for people at, 48,000, 50,000 and below. Just a point well made, I think, right? But even for all income groups, it's 5.4% CPI last year. Well, the wholesale price index is up 8.6% year over year. That means we're going to get more inflation bleeding into the consumer retail, the last stage of inflation. So inflation's continuing to go up. I expect the inflation rate between September this year and September next year to be between 5 and 7%. Significant. Well, what's the cause? Once again, our ideology friends, on the right, the same people who said it was too much unemployment benefits, why people aren't coming back to work, and we should also cut food stamps and child care. These same people, are saying that, we gave everyone too much money, the checks, the benefits, and so forth during the COVID, and there's too much money built up, and they're spending it all on. In other words, demand is driving up the price. No. Yes, there is some demand as we open up the economy, more than we had when we didn't open up the economy. Okay, but it's mostly a supply problem. Now, where I differ with the Federal Reserve, who says it's a supply problem, or Janet Yellen, the Treasury, the Biden administration, oh, it's a supply chain problem. Where I differ with their argument is that they say it's temporary. They said it was going to be over in a couple of months. It should have been over by now, according to what they were saying this summer. But it's not. The supply chain problem, the global supply chain is broken in many different product lines. It's broken. And it's going to take time for them to put it together. We're going to have the supply problem well into next year. So you can expect continued inflation and shortages for this or that for quite some time. Well, why? Why is the supply chain broken? Because when COVID hit, the shipping companies didn't have anything to ship, and they mothballed their fleets. And their sailors went off, who knows where. Now they're trying desperately to reopen those ships and get the sailors back. And that was a big disruption of the distribution system because of COVID. And that's reflected in factories not able to get workers as well, and a breakdown between production and distribution, particularly ocean shipping, right? Factories reduced their inventories to virtually nothing in many cases during the COVID, and now they're trying to ramp up, right? Now, Asia ramped up before us because China got its COVID under control initially, as did some other countries, and trade began to rebound in China and Asia faster than it's rebounded between Asia and North America or Asia and Europe. You see, Europe's got the same problems the U.S. does in terms of supply chain. Europe is even more exposed because they depend on exports and imports even more than the United States. Half of Germany's GDP is exports. Okay, so because Asia trade rebounded earlier, most of the ships that were coming back online went over to Asia, doing business in Asia, and there's now a big shortage of shipping for Asia, West Coast, U.S. trade. Big shortage. Plus, on top of this, worker shortages all along the chain. Well, Biden this past week said, had a press conference and said, we're going to fix the supply chain, right? And he pointed to the ports in Los Angeles, two ports, L.A. Port and Long Beach Port, where 40% of all the goods coming into the country come, those two ports. Well, He says, we're going to make them work 24/7. Remains to be seen, I think. Does that mean the longshore workers are going to work double shifts? Are you going to pay them double pay, overtime pay, Mr. Shipping Company? All right. Well, that remains to be seen. More importantly, though, you know, the big port by far is Long Beach. The big port has already been on 24/7. So you're only going to add the smaller port, Los Angeles, on a 24/7 schedule. But even if you do that, you see, 24/7, the problem is getting those containers off of the port docks and into the warehouses inland, you know, 30, 40, 50 miles inland is this tremendous system of warehouses in Southern California, right? They're short of workers. The truckers, 18-wheel guys, they're not pulling into the ports like they use. There's a shortage of them as well. A lot of them, small business people, probably went out of business, you see. Right? They can't find the truckers to pick up the containers, right? And if they can, there aren't enough warehouse workers to process those containers fast enough. And probably railroad workers and short-haul truckers picking up from the warehouses, you see. So it's a problem all along the chain. The chain does not stop at the port, right? U.S. Companies importing stuff from Asia are finding that while they used to pay $500 to $800 for a container, are now paying thousands of dollars for containers. Thousands, because there's a shortage of shipping. See, it looks like, oh, there's too many ships in the port of Long Beach sitting there unprocessed. Yes, but there probably should be even more because a lot of these have been diverted to Asia. Container costs is up 10%. Some of the retailers, big U.S. retailers, are renting their own ships now to try to overcome this. And there's going to be wage inflation to get the workers back in this supply chain. Now, on top of that, you've got a global commodity supply problem. Global commodities, what am I talking about? Well, mostly crude oil, right? Natural gas, coal even. Big shortage. Prices are going up. And you got this phenomenon of global speculators. Global speculators control what's available when there's a shortage of these commodities. They love that because they control the future contracts for these things. And they hold on to the final delivery of these because they own the contracts, waiting for the prices for commodities to go up. And boy, are they going up for commodities of all kinds, particularly for oil and for natural gas. Watch out this winter, everybody. Your natural gas prices are going to go through the roof. They will double. Yeah. Big thing coming. And, of course, crude oil is now over $80 a barrel. You know, let's think of some historical parallels here. You know, before the financial crash in the second half of 2008, we had the big run-up in oil prices, over $100 a barrel in the months leading up to the crash. I don't think anybody has really, maybe they have, but I haven't read, you know, the connection between oil prices and oil futures and speculating in oil markets that occurred in 2008 and the crash that followed. Are we heading for another financial problem? We might be here, you know. Housing is not in a problem in the United States. Yeah, but it's in a big problem in China. Yeah, Evergrande. I'll talk about those maybe next week, watching that. Big China property developers are going bankrupt. They're defaulting on their bonds and loans from, guess who? Western bankers. and hedge funds and equity and all asset management companies have loaned big time to China property markets, which are under risk of collapsing now. The contagion will flow from China to Western finance should that problem continue over there. Watch it, right? Watch it. Inflation in the U.S., double digit in many categories. New cars, used cars, semiconductor chips everywhere, which aren't just needed for cars. Appliances, food, especially meat, eggs, milk, right? Rents, over 10%. Housing prices, 15%. Utility prices, even before natural gas takes off, double digit. Gasoline, toys, everything going up. Mostly a supply problem. Supply relative to demand. See, look, you know, mainstream capitalist economics makes a fetish out of supply and demand. Oh, the problems are supply and demand. No, that's just a symptom. The real problems are what's driving supply and demand, you see? And the capitalists have created their own supply problem and the breakdown of their global supply chain. They're responsible for that. It's certainly not the worker, right? It's not, the worker's not coming to work in the global supply chain, at least, you know, the trade part of it. U.S. moved its production of so many things offshore to China and Asia, and now it's reaping the consequences. Okay, at the same time, we have 5.4% CPI, 8.6% wholesale price index, right? Continuation of supply chain problems and shortages going well into 2022. Inflation, at least 5% or more next year. Yeah. And we got workers going on strike, you know, like John Deere, 10,000 agricultural equipment workers went on strike here, you know. Why? Well, because the employer, John Deere, only wants to offer them 5% wage increase over 6 years. Yeah, I think it's 3% in the first year, nothing in the next one, then 1.5%, and then nothing in 2024, and then 1.5% wage increase. Well, that's 6%. Well, they're going to get that wiped out in inflation in 1 year. And then the company wants to cut pension benefits for new hires, you know, trying to create a two-tiered workforce. Well, they have everywhere in manufacturing. Take it out on the new workers, the young workers, you know. And then there's other cuts that they want to make. You know, they're not paying anything, and they're making huge profits. John Deere, huge profits. I think, like, I don't know what it was, $50, $60 billion or something like that, profits. And they give their CEO 160% increase in pay in the last year. And the workers look around and say, hey, we've been going nowhere for decades, and now you're giving us this paltry offer that's going to be wiped out in a year anyway. Well, they voted 10-1 to go on strike, and they're on strike right now. And bakery and confectionery workers at Kellogg's in Michigan, same thing. They're on strike. I'm talking about multiple plants. John Deere is like 14 plants in the U.S., you know? And now we got nurses on the West Coast, tens of thousands of them. You know, the Hollywood workers. Who's next? Unfortunately, union workers can only strike when their contracts expire. Not all of them are expiring right now. But the unorganized have no contracts. They can withhold their labor at any time, and they are. But we're going to have stagflation. Stagflation means you have stagnant real economic growth while you have inflation. Inflation is going to go up the next 6 to 12 months. At the same time, there's signs the economy is slowing down. Yeah, believe it or not. The Atlanta Federal Reserve District has shadow forecast for GDP, and it just cut its forecast for the third quarter from, I think it was 2.6% or 2.8, something like that, I think it's 1.3%, maybe 1.8. But they reduced their forecast for the third quarter. So it's only like 1.3% growth, real growth in the third quarter compared to 6.7% in the second quarter. Whoa, big slowdown in U.S. real economy while we're running into all these supply problems. And workers are not coming back to work. And inflation is beginning to take off, not short term. And at the same time, we got all this crap going on in Congress, right? Where you have two friends of the employers, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Yeah, big friends of the employers. I met with him, keep meeting with the employer groups throughout this whole thing and shooting down the Biden Build Back Better program, $3.5 trillion, which is now only $2 trillion. It might even be less when they come up with it, right? And progressives like Bernie Sanders and, you know, the squad and everything, they're squirming and jumping up and down, you know, and threatening this and that. And they have no leverage, ultimately, in the Democratic Party, which is run by corporate wing, which the point persons publicly are Sinema and Manchin. Doing the bidding. And why? Because they don't want to raise taxes to pay for a big Build Back Better bill. The infrastructure bill is not being paid for with tax increases. It's smoke and mirrors. And it's really only $550 billion over 10 years. It's nothing. Right? The Build Back Better was $3.5 trillion, but it's going nowhere. It may not even go. It may get shot down. They may throw in the towel because Sinema and Manchin won't do it. They won't even say what their counteroffer is, which means they just want to shoot it down, you see? So we're going into this inflation and slowing economy in the fourth quarter here, and global supply chain problems continuing with the government not providing a further economic fiscal stimulus. Just this tepid infrastructure bill, which won't begin to even hit an economy till second half next year. So there's nothing. And they're cutting out all the previous, you know, unemployment benefits and child care will expire at the end of December. You know, all this spending is going away for the rest of the folks. Ah, but the Federal Reserve keeps throwing $120 billion at the bankers, free money, every month. Oh, they're talking about cutting it back. Yeah, maybe they'll cut it back to $100 billion. Oh, the banks really need it, right? Yeah, they got record profits they just reported. Why the hell are we giving them $120 billion a month while we're cutting back everybody else? While the economy is slowing down. While inflation is escalating. Yeah, that's the scenario, folks. And that's why I've been saying and predicting for 18 months here that we're going to see a relapse. The rebound that was occurred this summer is going to relapse in the fourth quarter as it did last year. This is a deja vu economy. Okay, that's the reality. And we'll pick up the threads next week. I'm out of here.